This just very directly. Do you see any way of stemming the drift? What would have to be done to deal with this problem? These are last time's handouts, and this is the minutes from the last meeting, and this is what we're talking about right now.
Dallas, would it be useful for me to repeat the problem?
Yes, please.
The problem is, as it's stated, Christian colleges tend to move liberal and left over time. They start off as ministerial training schools. They want to enrich the minister's training by having other disciplines, so they hire faculty. Becomes increasingly difficult to find faculty or even value hiring faculty that accept the quote-unquote doctrinal statement of school. Right. So increasingly you have faculty that are not integrated into their Christianity. And his solution is tender problem, is not really the solution. Dealing with the authority of scripture is what he's trying to do. I think it's deeper than that. Is that the problem?
That is the problem. And let me ask you to hold on to that, and let's see if we have anyone who would react to your last comment. The solution, you're right, he says, is the authority of the Scripture. And let's see if you have some comments on that. Yes, go ahead.
I think what JP said about it deeper than that. Travel, I've met a lot of people that feel they hold an authority in Scripture, but their whole perspective on what truth and authority is has been such of a postmodern tack.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, that means that it means a variety of things, but in some cases that means they may be using terminology but attaching different definitions to it.
Mm-hmm.
When they use the word authority, they're talking about, we tend to use it in a much more concrete way, that it's the last word. They tend to make it, rather than the authority lying in the text of the Scripture, the authority lies in them as the reader to decide what they will take or not take out of the text. And because they don't think they can actually get to the text.
What an interesting point. Now, can you relate that point about they think they can't get to the text to what we've been discussing for the last 2 days?
Well, yeah, I think what you said the other day is the person who comes out with a true understanding and definition of what knowledge is will kind of hold all the cards, as it were.
Okay.
And it seems that there's a hunger to want knowledge, but they have taken knowledge, I'm trying to think of how to phrase it here, they've abandoned that knowledge can lie in something, and it can only end up lying only in their perspective of something, very Kantian kind of view.
Does that remind you of anything that Tom Nagel and McGinn and the others said? I quoted them at the outset.
Yes.
That's exactly what they said, wasn't it? So what you're up against now is something really very tough. And I think we would have to say, in the nature of the case, and for reasons which you very nicely stated, and all those reasons fall in the theory of knowledge. They all fall in the theory of knowledge. So the authority in the culture has shifted to what?
Institutions.
Which institutions? Right. What about these people that he mentions? It's a very nice statement. It's hard to justify hiring a third-rate Christian when you can get a first-rate non-Christian. What does that mean? Now, what is, you suppose, first-rate non-Christian? Who said they were first-rate? An institute, yes.
Say, seek a math teacher and give them the choice between two candidates, one of an
Baptist Church. They have an excellent Christian math teacher.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, how would they know that the non-Christian was first rate? Do they come with first rate written on their foreheads? No. How do they know that? And how would they know the quality of the papers published? You're saying right things. I'm just trying to lead you on because I want you to see how this works. How do you know that a paper is a good paper? And who would those be? Not people on the street. And which universities would you consult? The best universities. And who would tell you which were the best universities? The ultimate point of reference is actually the professional organizations. Well, the journals are very crucial in this process. And the other is the granting agencies. Journals and granting agencies are extremely important. Right. But if you watch it, you'll see that the professional organizations provide the framework within which the journals and the granting agencies and everything work. So that isn't a totally airtight system, but it's pretty tight. And what it all comes back to is this one question: who gets to decide what counts as knowledge? Now, suppose the people who get to decide that are empiricists. See? And suppose they haven't had anyone ever point out to them the weaknesses of naturalism as a theory of knowledge. Then they're just going to blunder along, and they're going to sort of, you know, you see these fish that you have 3,000 fish, and they all go at the same time? Or birds. Or flamingos do that too, you know. They all go at the same time. That's a perfect image of professional organizations. All the little signals are there somehow, and whoosh, whoosh. And if you're going the other direction, you just get run over, whether you're an institution or a person. Now, of course, we know that there's another institution called the Kingdom of God. Right? So we don't treat ourselves as if we were at the mercy of all this, because we're not. But we do need to understand it. And Mr. Biker, a fine man, but he hasn't solved his problem. And I have personally been engaged with a group of Christian college presidents, trying to get them to band together and stand up and say, Christianity represents a knowledge tradition. We know what it is. And we are not prepared to stand aside and allow others to tell us what counts as knowledge. And do we really think that a chemistry professor who knows only chemistry has as good an understanding of chemistry as someone who knows chemistry and also knows God? Now that scares most people, they're gone. You know, because the guy in chemistry knows that if he were to get over here and take this seriously, he'd be ruined. Or does he? Yes.
Well, I'm curious. One of the things that we've dialogued here, particularly with Dr. Moreland, is the problem of the general Christian community supporting the academics, even supporting those
right.
that really have a heart for God, getting the training that they need.
Yep.
In academia to be able to be out there. Like one of the goals of the program here is to put professors out there in other
right.
universities.
Right.
But that just seems that the problem is, although to one degree controlled by the academia, the institute, as it were, there's also other factors like getting the church in general to stand behind those that want to go get this kind of training, that want to take these kind of stances,
right.
to get them out there. How do you address that?
You put it right where it belongs. The church is a reflection of the ministry. And who trains the ministry? Now, if your schools that train ministers are in fact not just shadow images of so-called secular knowledge, then you've got a place to stand to train people. But that is the problem, is that, see, we have this cycle. Our ministers are basically trained in institutions that look to the secular schools as the models of what counts as knowledge. And when postmodernism comes through like that, just takes them right away. Did you get that? You had something to say. I'm sorry.
I think one of the points also is that we touched on, though, that there seems to be two different types of knowledge. They separate knowledge into two different types. So I could say somebody thinks the Bible is authoritative on this type of knowledge, say spiritual knowledge, but the chemistry, it's not the same type of knowledge. And I think that's also a problem.
It's a problem. It really is. And sometimes they won't even say that the other is knowledge. They'll say, well, that's faith. Right. It's not even knowledge.
Or you say, you raised John did a minute ago, I hope he knows his chemistry and he has a heart for God.
Yeah. Well, I hope he knows how his chemistry fits in with God.
Yeah, what is it to have a heart for God?
Right.
And is that going to include knowledge?
Yeah. Heart, soul, mind, and strength, the whole person. But you see, now we're in a situation where we can't imagine, I mean, generally speaking, people cannot imagine what it would be like to have a chemistry that fit together with theology. Partly that's because theology is in such an incredibly bad situation now. I mean, but you don't say that theology is the queen of the sciences, do you? No. But, so there's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of work to do. And so I appreciate your thoughts about that, your discussion of it, and I hope you'll keep thinking about it, because many of you are apt to be in your coming years in positions where you're going to be dealing with this. Because it's a very serious problem, and that idea of stemming the drift, it's always in one direction. Not quite true, by the way, but generally speaking, that's the way it works. Okay, now, I wanted to complete the discussion of... I think I will just leave the minutes for your review, and if you want to bring up things, you make notes on them, and we can always go back and get it, but I want to move on, and I want to tie the discussion of concepts last time to the two little selections from Brentano and Sartre on the back of your paper that looks like this on the front, okay? Because I want to try to give you these little pieces, very significant pieces of literature, concepts are the properties which constitute ofness and aboutness. And perhaps if you just write this down, intentionality is the general term for the ofness and aboutness that is characteristic of mental or cognitive states. And then concepts are just the particular ofnesses and aboutnesses that go into our consciousness of objects of all kinds. So now then, I'm hoping you can tie that on to the discussion of last time. We talked about concepts, corresponding properties, mental acts relating to the objects which have the properties, about the objects falling under the concepts in terms of the properties that they have, and so on. Okay. Now, Brentano is most famous in analytic philosophy as one who tried to state what this, or give a brief description of this. But everyone has to deal with it. You cannot avoid it as a thoughtful person, and especially as a philosopher. Now, of course, you understand that this very same phenomena in language is what we call meaning. It's called meaning in language. And one of the things that I would want to say is, of course, that meaning in language is derivative from intentionality in mental states. Others try to, especially those who want to reduce the mental to something else, will try to go the other way and say, no, there's linguistic meaning, and then as far as there is intentionality or mental states, that's just the meaning of languages. And then they'll try to give an analysis of what meaning in language is that's independent of this. I think it will always fail, but that's, I just call your attention to that. Now let me read a line, if I may, or two from Chisholm or Brentano. He says, every mental phenomena is characterized by what the scholastics of the Middle Ages called the intentional inexistence of an object. Now, the medievals, and you also find this in Descartes, speak of something called objective existence. And strangely enough, it means just the opposite of what we understand by objective existence today. It means existence as an object in a thought. So in existence, existence in. And that goes with the associated point that the object of consciousness need not exist. And this gets really strange, okay? Because on the one hand, you're saying, well, it exists in the consciousness, so it must exist. Yes, but, you know, it's not really it. It's like, you know, sophomores will say, Pegasus exists in my mind, right? Well, of course, he doesn't exist in your mind. If he existed in your mind, you'd have a big headache. Okay. Also, the term reference to a content. And the word content is one of those big philosophical weasel words that are so hard to nail down. It means generally whatever is contained in. Paul said, I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. But that's not the noun. But it does refer to the fact that he was contained. He wasn't jumping in every direction. He was able to be contained. You know, as we say to someone, contain yourself. Right? Okay, a direction upon an object. Another phrase. And then another one, very dangerous one, an imminent objectivity. Because that one really... Now, if you've been able to study the fifth chapter through, you'll recognize the discussion of that there. And Husserl very deftly sets this talk aside and doesn't want us to use it. And what he understands is you restrain yourself really to that idea of direction upon an object. And Brentano did not escape the dangers of this terminology. You'll notice he goes on each one, each mental phenomena include something as object within itself. And that's just disastrous, right? You have three ends as part, as property, and then the very dangerous one as object. The danger is that this one will be interpreted in terms of this one or possibly this one. So when we say, I had you in mind when I said, I didn't have you in mind as a part or a property, right? I had you in mind as object. So you had to be very conscious of these. And now what a doctrine of intentionality rightly developed will allow you to do is to make sure that you never confuse this with either of these. Now Husserl sometimes talks of this as intentional object. And this as immanent content. And now one of the things that approaching the material in the way we've done thus far is, I hope, helpful, is it starts out and it says, yes, any mental act or linguistic act has parts and has properties, and the parts have properties. And because the parts have the properties they do, they relate to one another in the way they do. And because the parts come together in the way they do, the whole has properties. And because it has properties, it relates to other things the way it does. Have I gone over that enough that you're sick and tired of hearing it? Because if you are, you'll remember it. And that is a fundamental piece of analysis. And you can use that anything you study. And what all I'm really doing is saying, look, let's apply the same approach to consciousness, its acts, its as we apply to anything else. See, this piece of chalk can write on a board. Let's see if you can do it now. That's what this piece of chalk does. Right? You write it. Now, why is it that this piece of chalk is able to write on the board, whereas my little pinky can't? Now, please go through it in terms of the analysis that I just went through. Well, you would start out by ascribing properties to the chalk, wouldn't you? You may not have quick language for that, but you know what it means. It has the property of being such that little pieces of it come off under friction on a board like this. Now, it won't do it on butter, right? Are you with me now? And please don't be impatient. Because if you get these, if you get this down, then you just move easily into so many different subject matters. So I talked about the property of this. Now, why does it have that property of rub off ability on a board? Well, because it has parts of a certain kind, doesn't it? And now these parts have properties, right? And because those parts have properties, they can come together to form a stick like that, which I can actually hold, right? And then it has the relation it has to other things, right? Now, every act of consciousness is exactly like that. In fact, everything is like that. So now, having an object is going to be a function of what on the board? Having an object, that's a kind of relationship to another thing, isn't it? like the relationship of the chalk to the board. Okay. So, this is going to be a function of this and this. Right? But this is not going to be either one of these. The object, I'm sorry, is not going to be either one of those. It rather is a term or a quasi-term of a relation or a quasi-relation. Actually, intentionality as such is not a relation, but what Husserl calls fulfillment or verification in Seller's language is. That's why, as you remember from reading the chapter, verification, like fulfillment, they're both tied to existence. They go together. But intentionality is not tied to existence. But fulfillment isn't tied to intentionality. See, the fulfillment depends on the care, on the specific intentionalities. Okay. So it's really very interesting to see how Husserl is working on exactly the same kinds of issues that, well, really we've been working on since Descartes. What we want is a description of a state of mind that guarantees existence. That's knowledge, right? Okay? And it's, I know that this gets awfully sticky, but I think all of you know something about the movement of philosophical ideas. And if you can see how this fits in, say, well, sure, Descartes was trying to do that. Not just any old idea was clear and distinct. And some of them that were not clear and distinct could be made clear and distinct. And if you made them clear and distinct, then you had existence, truth, reality. And that's what we're after. When you got that, you got knowledge. And so you go back to my formula. The act of knowledge is the representation of something as it is on the basis of appropriate thought or experience. Then we have to worry about what the appropriate thought and experience is. Husserl tells us, in one case, fulfillment. And we got into that a bit last time, and we'll finish it up today. But now, do you see the tie to Brentano? Intentionality. You see how intention, the whole discussion of intentionality fits in. Mm-hmm.
Allison,
oh, yes, please, anytime.
You're claiming that it is because a mental act has the properties and parts it does have.
Right.
It is then of the object it is of.
Right. Right.
If it had different properties and parts,
it would be of something different.
Object or of nothing, perhaps.
Right, exactly.
But it is in virtue of an analysis of the properties right. and parts of a mental act
mm-hmm.
that we are able to account for why the object is correct, is present for the target of that.
Right. You all understand that now, because that's a good way of putting it down. And we speak of supervenient properties. Mm-hmm. Okay. The direction of act A on object B, that's a property of the act, is supervenient upon the parts of act A and the properties and interrelations of those parts. Okay? So, for example, you could not have two acts that were exactly alike but of different objects. Tom?
Does it say something further about when you say that it's also by virtue of an act, parts and properties, that the act
fulfillment. Yes, exactly. Now let's think of how that would spell out in terms of my model here. What that says is the parts and properties and the properties of the whole act determine what relations it can enter into, right? That means two other acts. So Husserl's thesis is that any representation specifies a sequence of other acts moving, as it were, toward the object. And then finally, the object itself. Right? Now this is the part that, you remember we said that there were three issues about objectivity: law, community, and transcendence. The transcendence part is the hardest part to get. The transcendence part comes where the sequence of acts comes to an act which catches up the whole sequence and relates to the object itself. And at that point, you have a whole consisting of the object and the sequence of acts fulfilling themselves finally in the object itself. And when you get there, this is not another act. That's why this is genuine transcendence. So now, in a sense, you had transcendence all along, because the first act here was intentionally directed on the object. It was not of or about the next act. See, now go back to Case last time, you know, walking towards the tree and seeing it better and better. All along, the tree has been the object. And the direction of the intention is on the object. It isn't on something inside the mind. And so, really, you remember the discussion of Moore in the chapter, you're outside the circle of ideas anytime you have as an object something other than an idea. Intentionally, you're out. Your mental arrow, as it were, has already leaped out in the world. Now, that is what Mr. Sartre is hollering about. But then when you add the fulfillment, then you now have a whole of which the object is a part. You have achieved relationship to that object. And this whole cannot exist without the object. The object can exist without the whole. And that's crucial to our discussion, because the object has an existence in its own right. It is, as I quoted, you remember the quotations from Pitkin and the other American New Realists, R.B. Perry. If you didn't see those, do make a point to look over those, because they really bring it home. Maybe we could just take a moment right now and look at that before going back to Sartre. This is on a page something or other. Yes, on page 241 and following. You have this transcendence in the presence of the object itself on the chapter 5, okay? Page 241. And now what I just went over about fulfillment as it moves towards the object and then finally the object itself, the quotation right at the bottom of 241 covers fulfillment up to the point of the object, and that's where your intention finds its satisfaction. But what I wanted to make sure you noticed, let's just use the quotation on the middle of on the top of 243 from Perry. The specific response, this is the second paragraph there, R.B. Perry points out that specific response which determines an entity to be a content, now this is object, okay, content there means object, of consciousness does not directly modify such entities otherwise than to endow them with this content status. Namely, they are now in this relation of fulfillment. Given this, one can allow that the same entity possesses both immanence by virtue of its membership in one class and also transcendence by virtue of the fact that it may belong also to indefinitely many other classes. In other words, immanence and transcendence are compatible and not contradictory predicates. And now if you go back here, you can see a part as part cannot exist outside the whole. If the property, especially if you're a nominalist, your properties are going to be parts. That's really what it comes down to. But as object, you're not a part, you're not a property, you're simply standing in a relationship. And you can be in that relationship, and that's immanence. And with reference to the whole consisting of the terms relationship together, it's a part of that whole, but not a part of the mental side of the whole. So transcendence and immanence are compatible in nearly every relation. Now, again, I don't think you will have had a chance to study this, but Russell and others in this century came out of a context in which the relationship between consciousness and its object was treated as what we call an internal relation. That is to say, it entered into the essence of the object. That was one way of really clamping the lid on the mind so that anything that was in it couldn't be outed. And what Pitkin and Perry and Husserl and others are saying is, look, you know, things enter into relationships. And they go out of those relationships. And those relationships don't transform them. Same thing in, same thing out. And that's how to understand the relationship of object. Look at the Sartre piece now just for a moment. This one, intentionality, a fundamental idea of Husserl's phenomenology. The main point of what Sartre is doing here, he has just discovered transcendence. And he's very happy. He's a happy man. And he really thumps French idealism that he grew up in. He says, he devoured her with his eyes. This expression and many other signs point to the illusion common both to realism and idealism. And I'm not going to take time to spell out what that means unless you ask me, aside from the class, because it isn't worth our time. To know is to eat. After 100 years of academicism, French philosophy remains at this point. We've all read Brunschvig, Lalande, and Meyerson. We've all believed that the spidery mind trapped things in its web, covered them with a white spit, slowly swallowed them, reducing them to its own substance. What is a table, a rock, a house, or a biblical text, right? You know, Stanley Fish stuff about, is there a text in the room? The answer is no, of course. A certain assemblage of contents of consciousness, a class of things of such contents. Oh, digestive philosophy. Yet nothing seems more obvious. Is not the table the actual content of my perception? Is not my perception the present state of my conscious? Nutrition, assimilation? Lalande said of things to ideas, of ideas by ideas, of minds by minds, the corpulent skeletons of the world are picked clean by these diligent diastases. Assimilation, unification, identification. A great weariness comes over me when I read this because you just think of the centuries that these simple distinctions have been missed and the loss of knowledge. You almost have to feel that there's a bit of unoriginal sin in all of this. But of course you don't say that to people who accept it, because that won't help. So Sartre has discovered this, you see, and now he finds the world is there to be known, to be enjoyed, without being transformed into one's own substance. Doug.
Now, this discussion of the whole,
right,
which transcendence is part, is a discussion of knowledge. But intentionality is involved in cases where you have everything but.
Absolutely. We don't have fulfillment.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that's tricky there, Doug, is even in those cases, the object is outside the mind. It's just that we don't even know whether it exists or not.
Yes.
Right. So
what I wanted to comment on how the term object is being used in these cases. Mm-hmm. And the comment that you made part of
right. It's simply that this direction determines some particular thing, and whatever that is. Right. So, and this will always be in terms of some properties or context. So, for example, we can all talk about Pegasus, and we all know exactly what we're talking about, and we all are talking about the same thing. Your images may differ a little bit from mine. Mine may have mobile written over it or something of that sort. You may not be old enough to do that, but, you know, we all, it's different, but it's the same. And the signs exist, but the horse doesn't. And yet we all achieve community with that object, a non-existent object. So now that will be true of many things where we don't push this issue of whether or not it exists. And
you, at this point, you're just giving the analysis of what goes on in the
app. Right. That's right. Right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is real?
But it has,
no, it doesn't. What is real is the direction.
Okay.
That has existence. That really exists. Now, let me go back here and read
a.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So it's just the pointer.
The pointer is there. Yes. Now let's look at a little passage here from Husserl on this. Because that happens to be, and this is the, Doug, this is the long quotation running from 219 to 220 in that. And I'm actually in this, I'm discussing on page 219 Husserl's differences from Brentano. Brentano never got this thing straight. Brentano still bought the idea that you had to have some kind of an object. It would just be in the mind. Now, look at what Husserl says. And this is such an important passage here. And then the paragraph following the quotation on 220, I chew it for you again. Intentional experiences have the peculiarity of directing themselves in varying fashion to presented objects, but they do so in an intentional sense. An object is referred to or aimed at in a judging or presentational fashion. This means no more than that the experiences, Erlebnisse, are present. Intentional in character, that means they're about something. And more specifically, as presentingly, judgingly, desiringly, or otherwise intentional. Those are what he calls the qualities. There are, to ignore certain exceptions, not two things present in experience. That's where he disagrees with Brentano. Brentano never gets over this. And also Meinong, to throw in another name, which you don't need to worry about, but you might have an interest. We do not experience the object, and besides the iron curtain, which you can never get out of. Right. Now, Husserl does not have that. There are not even two things present in the sense of a part and a whole which contains it. only one thing is present, the intentional Erlebnisse, the intentional experience, whose essential descriptive character is the intention or the intending in question. If this experience is present, then by that, in virtue of that, and through its own essence, the intentional, quote, relation to an object is achieved, and an object is intentionally present. But now, of course, it's not achieved in this sense that its existence is guaranteed, because it can be achieved when the object doesn't even exist. In the light of this, it becomes clear why the mere intentional direction of the act is indifferent to the existence or non-existence of the respective object. To have a thought of the god Jupiter, or Zeus, might traditionally have been described as having that god imminently present or mentally inexistent in my mental act. But this, we now know, means only to have a certain presentational experience, which may be dismembered as one chooses without turning up the god. The so-called immanent or mental object is accordingly not any part of the descriptive immanent stuff of the corresponding experience. But Jupiter also does not exist extramentally, even in some super refined realm of being. He just does not exist at all. If, however, the intended object does exist, nothing becomes different in the experience itself. Now, in the fulfilling experience, something would be different. I mean, suppose you climbed Mount Olympus, and there was Zeus. Well, that would correct your experiences for sure. You would have an experience of disappointment, not fulfillment. Right? And you would, but you were thinking about Zeus all the time. You didn't suddenly become thinking about something else when you discovered he really existed. So the intentional direction is the same, no matter where the object exists or not. What is not the same is the fulfillment. JP.
Would you, in summary, describe that diagram one more time with an eye on this? Would you talk about it? What is it about it that makes it a fulfillment structure in terms of empty and less empty intentions? Could you just do that?
So people can yeah. This is the tree. Okay? And so here I am standing way back here, and I see it, and it's a tree. But now tree has lots of empty ideas, like what kind of tree? I know it's got to be some kind of tree, but I don't know if it's a sycamore tree or a maple at this distance. Now as I go closer, what happens is the bark, the leaves, the shape of the leaves, color of the leaves, and so on, become present to me. And that is the progressive fulfillment structure. At this distance, I know the leaves have a shape, but I don't know what shape it is. And as I approach it, the shape is present to me. So progressively fulfilled as I move closer and closer to the tree. Now, I actually, in the case of the tree, I can't come down to the place to where every aspect intended is present, because for one reason it has an inside. And I can't see all sides at once. But I can walk around it, and I can fulfill many of those empty intentions progressively. And so that's the way that it goes. Now, back here, I still see that tree, that same tree. And as I walk towards it, its parts and properties, which I know must be there, but I don't know what they are, and they're not present, they become present to me. And that is the dimension of fullness, as he calls it.
What is so wonderful about this to me is that this roots knowing in ontology, in the sense that, in this sense, the object itself is what determines the fulfillment structure.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Trying to break out of it, right. And I've got these ideas trapped in mm-hmm.
right.
And I've got to figure out, it's kind of arbitrary, and I'm comparing these things, and I can't get out of it.
Yeah, and you can see, JP, how historically it's almost inevitable that we're going to turn to some form of constructionism, because that's all we've got. That's all we've got.
So
We have to make the thing up somehow. And so Kantianism and various other forms of construction, they just become inevitable.
But the mind also has to be structured in the right way.
Right.
They complement. Mm-hmm.
They do. They do. And okay, now that's why what I said the other day, true or false, is at least very important, about how concept ties to quality. Because that's the basic mesh between the mind and the object, is the concepts and the qualities corresponding to it, and then, of course, the qualities in the object. That is what comes together. When the qualities are given to the concepts, that's where the... Now then, think a moment. Let's go back to Wilford, dear Wilford. We're confronting a token sentence with a token sense data. All we've got is confrontation. Why? Because he has no nature that meshes them. There's no mesh. There's nothing that brings them together. Historically, over and over, resemblance was tried. The idea would resemble. But the problem with that is that resemblance is too big to get intentionality from. You have five cherries in a bowl. They resemble one another, but they are not about one another. Resemblance won't do it. And Husserl is very conscious of that, and we won't go into that part of his story, but it's a very big one.
How does this notion of intentionality differ from this notion of matter? It's a portion of cognitive matter.
Let's look at page 218 just a moment. Actually, it doesn't. No, I mean, the intentionality is the matter, but the matter has two parts. And on page 218, I've listed here the components. A and B together form the matter. And compare that to the top of page 223. Matter, then, is that aspect of the act's content which determines the object and the way. Right below the quotation. See that? And the way. The two things there, which object it is and how the object is presented. You know, those of you who know Frege, that's the sin. The sin, S-I-N-N. The how. Husserl often says, das wie, the how. How is it given? Every object is given in a certain way. So now, I think you all know morning star, evening star stuff, right? So morning star is the wie. It's the how. It's the way. The same thing given in different ways. Morning star, evening star. Venus is the same planet. So what you have here on 218 now is the breakdown of the main parts of the whole mental act. And there's the reference on the object, which is A. That object, which object? You want to write there, which object? Second, the same object but apprehended on different aspects or predicates or in a different sense. That's the V. That's the how it's given. So the victor of Jena and the vanquished of Waterloo. It's Napoleon in both cases, right? But the victor of Jena is a different how. Same, but you see that's a difference in the act now. Because you're conscious of Napoleon in a different way. You cannot have one of these without the other. You can't have a way without a that or which, and you can't have a which without a way. Husserl thought these were inseparable parts of every cognitive act. And then, of course, C is the propositional attitude, judgingly, rememberingly, representingly, and that can change while A and B remain constant. And then D is the aspect of fullness. To what extent is the object You can have the same object, the same V, the same attitude, but a different degree of fullness. As I walk towards the tree, I have the same, I believe that it's a tree, it's presented in the same way, but the details are more fully given, yes. In the full, in the D. Now, the trick here is you have to understand that sensa is not the only way that things are filled out. Because, for example, when you reflect on your own perception of something, suppose you've changed your glasses or something, and you know that things don't look right, but you don't know how. You don't know what's happened. Now, what's your trouble there is you have a mental event, your perception, that is present to you because you realize something is wrong, but you don't know what it is. So you can actually have an unclear consciousness of a mental event. But that's not a problem with sense data, because sense data don't correspond to mental events. Right. A concept also. We can, you know, we can be using a concept, but not be sure about what all its parts are. But that isn't a sense problem. And I have to come at the end of the discussion today to talk more about this, because we can't go away from this without talking about the question of how we are aware of mental acts. And we have to say what we can on that topic, because it's all important. Yes?
You say as you approach the tree, you have a series of, I think the phrase you used was empty ideas?
Empty intentions or concepts, yeah.
Would that be fair to describe those as parts of the...
Yes.
...that we're talking about?
Exactly.
And then the properties are, as you get closer, mm-hmm. you understand that there's a certain kind of greenness to this leaf.
Right.
That tells you there's a certain kind of tree that fills out what these parts are.
Right. Now that's crucial, because if those empty parts weren't there, we wouldn't have the phenomena of fitting that goes in. And that is crucial to the concept of transcendence in the strong sense that Husserl spells out.
Mm-hmm.
By all means.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
There are parts of that act that are called matter. They're not physical. That's just the term used for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the parts that, number one, determine what object my act
is directed on. Right.
And secondly, the manner, the aspect of the object.
Yes.
That it is a
green
object, or it's
right.
My uncle's favorite object, or whatever.
Right.
Then there's an addition to that, maybe the propositional attitude, I'm hoping it's a tree or judging, but that isn't the matter.
Mm-hmm.
The matters are those constituents of the act, and they're not physical, they're just, that's the word you use.
Mm-hmm.
That
right.
Make the act
matter is opposed to form,
okay.
In this case. And they're what determine how that is going to develop.
Okay.
And of course, for example, seeing that star as the morning star and the evening star is a guideline as to how you would investigate it more closely. And to use other language, you see, appearance is the guide to reality. Absolutely. The matter determines rigorously. And so that's why, for example, if we wish to test an argument for validity, we don't write it on paper and dip it in acid to see if it turns purple. Right? That would test for something, but not for validity of an argument. Why? Because of the kind of thing an argument is. Yes?
Still trying to get a handle on this.
Good. Right.
Right. Is that right?
Right. You won't even, you may not know that they're the same. Right. And the concept of Venus, you'll have to talk about how that's given to you. What is the sense of the star? Now, traditionally, of course, it was a goddess. You're not one of those infamous slug-a-beds that Smart talks about that never gets up in the morning.
A lot of data about it, I'm thinking about it, but I'm still missing components of it.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't stayed up late at night.
Right. Absolutely.
In my sense, what I'm intending is not fulfilling
it. Mm-hmm. Right. See, I mean, what's to be filled in? What you're trying to fill in is the trajectory of that thing you call the evening star. And to have discovered that it is the same thing as the morning star is to fill in at once a huge set of empty intentions.
And he's asking about what is a hole. You've got a hole there.
You do, right. Just like I have a hole, if I see a tree away off and I just recognize that that must be a tree. That's still a whole object. Well, yeah.
In each moment along this stage of coming to know the object better,
mm-hmm.
there is a mental act, and it's a whole.
Yeah.
It has parts, and it's directed upon an object.
Mm-hmm.
And the object
is a whole. And in the mental act, there are a lot of empty intentions.
And then you've got the whole part of the whole.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Say that again. That's part of the whole. So with different, as fulfillment occurs, I don't know if enriched or whatever works here.
Yeah.
As the fulfillment sequence progresses,
mm-hmm.
The whole changes, doesn't it?
The act changes. Right. It does. Because more and more of these empty things are filled out. And the star case is a real interesting one, because the original account, when people realized that it must be the same, was that it sat in a river in the west and floated around to the east and came up again in the morning. Now that was a real struggle. But they had, I guess just through the similarity, they had recognized that it was the same star, the same hole, if you wish. So they were trying to fill in those gaps. And of course what theory does is it fills in gaps. But not intuitively. It tries to give explanations as to what this is. And of course the original story was that this was actually a person. Right? And wasn't it Anaximander that got killed because he said it wasn't? I think it's Anaximander. And actually the charge of impiety against Socrates had to do with the suggestion that these planets might just be dirt and rock. That was a part of the charge. So you see all of that, those empty intentions, they really get the thrashing around there. And it's very hard. Now then, I mean, imagine what happens when you fly, what was it, Voyager 2 past Neptune? And you actually see this incredible thing. Remember when we've got the first shots of the Earth from the Moon? You talk about fulfillment. See, that's just the real stuff. That's what Husserl is talking about. Back over here. Yes, you. Mm-hmm. Oh, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. I have an idea in mind, and that idea has parts and properties that are of, let's say, a tree.
Right.
And then I have that tree in my mind in the sense that...
that it is the object of the direction.
Right.
So that's this one here.
The parts and the properties of my idea are fulfilled
in the parts and the properties of the tree.
When the parts and the properties of the tree match the idea.
You got it. That's exactly right. Now I've given a lot of quotations in this chapter. That spell this out in the section on transcendence. I was actually looking for one especially good one, which I don't seem to be able to locate right now. Because there's one that's just a jewel. Well, this section on fulfillment has a lot of them in it, but I'll let it go. Tim. Well, it's a difference between hearing the telephone ring and thinking about it ringing. And you know the difference between that. And the contrast between empty and full is what he calls a descriptive difference, which you simply have to pick up from cases. But you can't say anything more about it other than circumlocutions like, well, the object itself is not present. But see, if you ask for a definition or description of presence other than the contrast with absence or emptiness, I don't think there's any way you can devise that. So it's he uses all this language about the bodily presence of the object. The object itself is present, and so on. But that's just sort of waving your hands. And you have to satisfy yourself whether or not there is a difference there. And then the absence, that's just the emptiness. So it's, you think, you can give all kinds of cases that you recognize. You know, you think about, why do you want a picture of your sweetheart in your wallet? Answer, to make her more present. Why isn't it good enough just to think about her? Well, it just ain't, right? You want that picture, and so on. Yes, and then Tom.
Is it possible to, I'm looking at this tree, or I'm looking at this object, I don't even know if it's a tree yet. I'm certainly aware that it has some sort of semblance of parts, mm-hmm. but I have very little clue on what the properties are.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm asking is it, can you have this thought structure that allows you to understand multiple parts but attach very, very little meaning to them? Would that still be an empty intentionality or empty
yes.
idea?
No, that's true.
Okay,
but on the other hand, you can have cases where you have something brutally present but no ideas about it. In that case, you don't even have empty ideas. The case we were using the other night, talking with someone, is when you unexpectedly bump your head. That's an interesting case. Because there is a presence with no accompanying ideas. And at the moment that it occurs, you don't have knowledge of it. You're just sort of stunned. And for Husserl, you must have both concepts and present to have knowledge, both. And the characteristic case is where we have very little intuition and lots of concepts. And he's, of course, thinking primarily about his own field, mathematics, which is That's the usual case. Almost no intuitions, but tons and tons of empty intentions buried in mathematical formula.
Okay, so as you become more familiar, you may not need to add parts, but as you become more familiar with properties, then you can start having a greater intentionality toward that object because you can begin to identify it, and there's a greater presence, and that brings
right.
you about fulfillment. So it strikes me that really does great damage to Hume's position that our understanding of all lies within us, and it draws us to the external object itself.
Husserl would love you. That's exactly his point. And he thinks that is one of the great strengths of the position he's laying out, because I started in this saying, now let's treat knowing and acts of cognition as natural wholes. And if you do that, then they fit with their objects. And you can say how they fit. Not that you explain everything, you don't. It's still, a lot of it's mysterious, but at least it's not just kind of weird.
Well, this correction is really going to do some severe damage to the subjectiveness of knowledge. It's going to draw us back to a more objective basis because it's not lying within us.
I'm happy to hear that. You see, what this does is this treats these acts of experience, cognition, and so on, as if they were natural entities in a world Well, that got you out of the dreadful subjectivity also, you see. Because the subjectivity is based on, I drew that line, it's based on sort of pulling that stuff over in here and changing their nature, and now you never get out.
And rather than leaving it out.
That's exact. Yeah. Leaving it out there and saying it's quite accessible.
Right.
And here's how. This gentleman here back.
Yeah, I want to conceptualize these empty intentions as kind of an expectation I have for this object, but Husserl says not to do that.
Right. Now, that's a bit of his very careful description, and you'll notice why he says that, because we intend things that are not in the future. Expectation is towards the future. So now, he gets very, he was always accused of what the Germans call überflüssige Spitzfindigkeit, an excessive sensitivity to distinctions. But you know,
that would make a great t-shirt for here.
Oh, am I going to get someone in trouble?
You're not coming back now.
Überflüssige Spitzfindigkeit. Überflüssige Spitzfindigkeit. But you see, it isn't superfluous. Right, JP? It is not superfluous. And so he just wants to make sure that we understand that all these differences. Now, on the other hand, what's involved in expectation is obviously often some kind of empty intention. And you could probably turn it around and say, without empty intentions, no expectations. Right? John Dreyer and I, one of my colleagues, once had someone pay a lot of money to a school of management to give a course to some of us whom they thought they were grooming for various things. And after a laborious presentation, this gentleman presented the thesis that that surprises come from the unexpected. And we sat there and thought about that and concluded it was probably true, but not worth the money. And so that's empty intentions, right? Surprises come from empty intentions. And suddenly they're fulfilled, and so you're off. Okay. Now, let me just, and we'll take a quick break, but let me just, Tom, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask you quickly about the relationship between concept as a constituent of an act of knowing.
Right.
And structure of fulfillment. And I'm wondering, as you move along in the structure of fulfillment, there's a sense in which your concepts become enriched.
That's right, they do.
Do they maintain identities throughout this process, or do
yes. Husserl's view is that they maintain identity, that what happens is we understand them better. And in this regard, Husserl is something of a Humean. He says, oh, you want your idea clarified? Find the corresponding impression, match it up. And what will happen is you will find that concept articulating for your understanding. But it doesn't become a different concept on his view. Now, of course, we all know the problem with terms like mass and so on, developing in the history of science and so on. Obviously, in those cases, sometimes the concept associated with the word becomes a different one. A different concept is associated. Because the concept's a familiar story, the concept is buried in the theory and so on. But that's a discussion that you have to introduce language into. To get that. The concept itself, I mean, it can be replaced. And for example, we might find that that things that we thought fell under the concept didn't. We thought the whale was a fish, now we know the whale isn't a fish. But the concepts themselves don't change. They are universals, and they may replace one another. And in some cases they do, but the concept itself does not change. Any more than green changes when the apple becomes red. Right. I just wanted to, before a quick break here. Look at the, I have a comment here on Sellers in at bottom of 231. See, I realize, you know, and of course in writing this, my head is thoroughly buried in Sellers and in Husserl, and so I'm looking at them. And you realize looking at them, it all looks kind of fantastic, you know. Why not say the same things about Husserl that I said about Sellers? Why say that in Husserl's case, to use my language, there are no blurs? Primitives, but no blurs. Well, as I say at the bottom of 231 here, there is much that is strange and unexplained in Husserl's views, no doubt. But the objection to Sellers was not that there are things for which he offered no explanation, or that seem strange in their ultimacy. As C.I. Lewis has remarked, the mind, and particularly its purpose and activity, is of course ultimately mysterious, as reality altogether is ultimately mysterious. Top of the next page. The general point against Sellers was, instead, that he introduces identities and possibilities and necessities in the form of and by means of various dimensions of linguistic reality, but with no clarification of the ontological structures within the languages and its accomplishments in cognitive processes, how that can be understood. I do not think that any similar charge can rightly be brought against Husserl on the matters in question, although that alone does little to show that his is the true view of verification and fulfillment. If our interpretation is correct, he does stay within the bounds of a plausible pattern of explanation in terms of potentialities and necessities grounded in regional essences. That just means essences that belong to the mind as opposed to body, for example, or the basic properties of a major category of entities. And he attributes to mental acts certain processes and accomplishments of which, in the light of their known properties, they might reasonably be thought capable. It does not seem to me that the same can be said of Sellers' account of language in verification and cognition, and I would extend that also to the Locke and Kant and all the others we talked about. That, I think, is the difference. Now, of course, I'm just presenting that to you, and you will have a critical understanding of it that you will develop. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and try to finish this up. Brief paper topic. Okay, and now I'm going to see how many people have fainted when I turn around. And is that possible? Ontologically clarified whole. Now, this is the story about how everything has to be understood in terms of its parts, the properties of the parts, how the parts then go together in the whole, and how that gives properties to the whole, determines what kind of whole it is, and then that determines what kind of relations it can enter into. And then apply that, and you could discuss Locke or Kant or some. You've been doing Kripke. We talked about Kripke. You could use the same thing there, and the idea that blurs show up where you just don't know what's going on. And you think that, can we try that? You know, if it's a disaster, we'll just forget it. And Tom can declare whether it's a disaster or not. Okay.
Why the ellipsis?
Well, just, I wanted to leave that. I didn't want to decide between knowing a person or knowing that P or knowing the alphabet. That's an illustration I used. So you pick any of those. Knowing is, remember, knowing thus far, we just have that general description. Knowing is representing something as it is on a basis of, on an appropriate basis of thought and experience. Now, of course, fulfillment would be one way of filling that in, but we're going to be working on that for the rest, much the rest of the course, that appropriate way of thinking or experience. So is that, if you don't just feel, now nobody has fainted yet, so let's try that, okay? And seriously, this is terribly difficult stuff. I mean, if I'm right, nearly everyone else has been wrong about this, right? So it must be hard. It must be hard. But I really hope by this time I've sort of gotten you to think it kind of makes sense that you should approach knowledge in this way. And that possibly the failure to do that is what leads us into this position where, as we started out, you have no way of knowing what things are apart from our knowledge of them, our conscious of them.
Now, she said something yesterday, the day before, that you really must clarify, if not today, then some other time. You said that when it comes to knowing persons,
yeah,
part of the epistemology of that is ethics. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's right, that has significant implications for apologetics and helping people come to know God. And you've got to say something about that, not now.
And Russell's statement to God, right?
Right. And so you
why didn't you give me more evidence?
You can't just drop these things.
Well, gee, JP, that's hot. That's tough. That's tough. Well, maybe, seriously, maybe we can talk about it some later on. Obviously, I think it is a very important point. Yes. Right.
It seems like you're taking Husserl, and you bring out a problem that Husserl identified, is approaching theories of knowledge,
right,
which is an epistemological category.
Mm-hmm.
And that problem is that somewhere in the mix is lost the external world.
Right.
We have a common sense understanding.
Right. The problem, now that's conceded. I mean, Kant said it is a scandal to philosophy that had not been able to prove there was an external world. So that I take as, Husserl would regard that as a given.
Okay.
I would too. And I gave you the quotations from various writers.
So that's the problem, but trying to deal with that problem, people go down different roads. Mm-hmm. And the road that they think ends them up with no possibility of getting out the external
yeah.
world, which is being locked inside ourselves, the physical mm-hmm. environment.
Right. Right. Exactly right.
Now, right. The problem I have is being able to adjudicate between the two. Is it just a matter of what I'm more comfortable with?
Mm-mm. No.
Is that where we're going?
No, I mean, you will have to give reasons, right? And surely one reason will not be, I don't feel comfortable with this. The question will be, why don't you feel comfortable with it? So give your reasons. See, now, this whole idea, what are the constituents, parts, properties, interrelations, relations to other things of knowledge? As act or event and as condition. How is knowledge and its constituents positioned in reality as a whole? Sorry, that's from the minutes from last time, not this time. That number three, the topic of the course. And see, you remember my initial presentation was, people have talked as if they were going to answer this question. And then they got hijacked, and they, especially by the questions, what do we know, what can we know, rather than what knowledge is. And so this issue, which is vital, slips out of the horizon of their mental vision disastrously. And they wind up with these really pretty crazy ideas when you stop to think about it, that Sartre very nicely parodies as digestion, right? Because they really do. You slip into that. That's what makes so many people, I mean, you think, Tom Nagle, Colin McGinn, Hillary Putnam. I mean, who's smarter than these people? But they're all taken in by this. I believe taken in. Now, of course, the other one would be, no, Willard, you're wrong. That's really the way it is. And, of course, anyone's free to argue that. But you've got the line, whatever you decide to do with it. You've got the line of argument. And, of course, all I say to you, no, it isn't just how you feel about it. What are your reasons? Yeah. I don't care anything about Husserl. I mean, it's my theory. Okay. I'll stand back of it. I use Husserl because I want to do justice to him. He was a good man and a great philosopher and is practically totally inaccessible. And so, but I, no, I defend the theory. You forget about Husserl, I still defend the theory. Yeah, I do. You want me to do it? Right. So, I mean, what would you count as outside? How about a shoe and a sock? So here's a shoe and there's a sock. It's on a foot. Right? Now, it is not a part of any mind, right? So the external world exists. If you want to see this done more cleverly, read G.E. Moore's Proof of an External World.
Right? I guess what I'm a bit.
I mean, why would you think that is not an external world? Right, and now in order to answer that question, you'll have to tell me a story about all the parts and properties and how they are mental, won't you? Right? And that's historically, that's how it's done. So what Husserl is doing is showing how, in a systematic way, he's showing why all of those arguments fail. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm wondering where this adjudicating that.
Well, just take the first person's perspective. Don't worry about the other one. The first person's perspective is the one that causes the trouble, isn't it? And say what it is about the first person's perspective that makes this shoe and that sock mental. From the first person perspective. And you will go the route that we're all very familiar with. There isn't any other route.
Have I not changed
shoes? It's like you just got me with my shoes, is all. Well, yes, Doug.
I want to ask you about how you harmonize a couple of passages.
Okay. Two twenty.
Right. Actually, bottom page 19.
Okay. Right.
And this was, I think, where you turned our attention to when I asked about
right.
whether it matters whether the object
exists. Mm-hmm.
Of course, here we have a case described where the object doesn't exist.
Right.
And then on page 220, at the middle of the following the long quote.
Mm-hmm.
These were diffrontpluseral. If, however, the intended object exists, nothing becomes phenomenologically different.
Right.
Now,
remember, this is not at the moment of fulfillment, but at the moment simply of thinking of Jupiter.
Okay, well, this may be the answer.
Right.
But later on the page, below the discussion of Perry,
right,
you're talking about the, in a little paragraph, the transcending relationship.
Right.
And the last.
Now that's the fulfillment. We're talking here about the fulfillment relationship.
Okay, right. The felt congruence.
Right.
Between the sense of the thought and that of the intuition bounds the relation to the object.
Right.
Now, could you talk about the relationship between these two planes, where you've got reach and connection, I guess, to the object in active cognition?
Right. So you have actually, it's more complicated than I've shown. You have a sequence of empty intentions and increasingly fulfilled, fulfilling. Intuitions. Okay. And these are matching up. Or just imagine that they are. That these, you're walking towards the tree or whatever it is, and as you approach it, these increasingly are fulfilled by this stream down here. Yeah. They match up as you go along. Now, ideally, at a certain point, you would have, if you, this won't do for the tree case because you can never fulfill even a high percentage of them. There are so many of them. But if you have a simple case, such as whether or not you're experiencing a perception of me right now, right? That's one where you can have maximal fulfillment. Not of me, but of your perception of me and your awareness of that perception. Yes, right. And in general, only certain abstract universals and mental acts are capable of total fulfillment. So at a certain point here, the relationship to the object, which in that case would be your perception of me, relationship sets in. Not mere intention, but fulfillment sets in. So that's a relationship. Now you have the whole, which guarantees the existence of the object. The whole guarantees the existence of the object because the object is a part of that whole. But the object is not a part of the experience directed upon it. That's where the transcendence comes in. It's outside it. Yes, that's his claim, is it's experienced, and I think that's right in my own reflections. I'm inclined to think that it is.
See, that would make sense, theoretically.
Okay, that's the quotation bottom of 241, just to refer you to it, Doug. I don't know, go ahead and make your point. I just wanted to give
I was going to say, that certainly seems right. I mean, it seems like as a point of your theory, that's what
That's, but it has to be phenomenologically verifiable for him. Right. Right.
The whole history we've been talking about constantly comes back to that point that they would actually, people like Descartes, others.
But now, suppose. But you're right. That has to be explained. Now, suppose the explanation of that is precisely what I have said, that they have failed to attend to the structure of the act of consciousness. Suppose that were it.
So the phenomenological difference might depend upon attending to structure.
It will depend. This is a big deal for Husserl. It actually is a big deal for Brentano. This is one of the things that Brentano taught over and over again, was the power of prejudgments and how prejudgments can keep you from seeing what is right down your throat. And Husserl returns to that over and over again, likewise. Now, I mean, that of course, now we're getting in on dangerous ground, because it's, you know, when people begin to speculate about the condition of mind of the people who disagree with them, that's dangerous. On the other hand, there might be something to it. It's like, you know, the guy who says, I'm not paranoid, they really do hate me.
You can say in that situation, both to them and to yourself, what you said in class in the hour yesterday, right? You are radically individual.
That's exactly right. And once again, this is the theme that Husserl and Brentano never let up on, is that you have to come to this from the inside. No one is going to stuff it down your throat. But on the other hand, I mean, you have this phenomena of all these high-priced intellectuals through the ages winding up fumbling around trying to find the world. And so surely there might be an explanation of that. But it's very, you see, if you don't have some sense of what is going on in an act of consciousness, the empty intentions and all that stuff that we talk about in the chapter, then you're going to be troubled about whether or not you can confirm the lock on the object here. And you may say, indeed, I can't do it. And you see, suppose if you thought this was confirming a sentence like Sellers does, you can see how one might be totally puzzled as to what goes on. Yeah, go ahead. Uh-huh.
But maybe in those cases, you have knowledge without the same phenomenological feel that knowledge has when the object is secured in that final act.
Right. Right. Okay. You have knowledge, but you don't know that you do.
Okay. All right. Now,
and Husserl thought that was a very common occurrence. He always felt that was kind of deficient, you know, because he didn't want to say, I mean, again, he was his stalking horse is mathematics. And he never says, gee, these people don't know. What he says is the field is in chaos. They don't know how they know. And so, but he always represents mathematics as the model of genuine knowledge. But it's precisely a field where they had no idea how they do what they do. So now, this is going to come up later on, probably. It's a real major issue as to whether or not you're going to say that if you know, you must know that you know. And I think it's a disaster if you say you must.
Yeah.
That's right. You don't need to say that. What you need to avoid is you can't know unless you know that you know. And that's what I think defeats more people than any other thing and drives them into skepticism, is they misunderstand that.
But you are sympathetic with the possibility of knowing that you know, if that means that you've got the
sure.
In some sense, there's some adequacy
yeah.
about the fulfillment structure.
That's exactly right. Because if you don't know what knowledge is, there's no way you're going to know whether you know, right? Indeed, it is. Show him your note. You already have. Yes. No, the internalism, externalism. One reason why I like to do it this way, Doug, is when you come to internalism, externalism, I think you can really make the issue sharp. You can really make it sharp at that point. But you see, I don't know how you feel about it, but I often read Burge and other people who write on this stuff. I don't know what they mean by inside and outside. What's inside and what's outside? Well, in order to say what's inside, that's it. That's it, you see. What you do this way is you explicate an inside and an outside.
It's all outside. There's only a third person perspective. It's a God's eye point of view.
Well, at least the first person's perspective is not sort of always concealed. Right? You don't wind up in a closet somewhere as the first person perspective. You're in the world with other people. But that's basically because you have explicated the act of knowledge in such a way that it doesn't create this wall. And how do you do that? You do it precisely by a theory of the relationship between experience and the object that does not transform the object. You, in other words, you explicate a relationship here that allows the object to be in that relationship and out of that relationship without losing it. Same object.
Is that we are capable of discerning this difference phenomenon once we work at it.
Right. Right. That's part of the argument. There are two arguments. One is the historical failure of the other approach.
And yet everybody says there's an external world.
Well, they say it, right. And they assume it. And, you know, if I'm right, those 3 points, community, law, and transcendence, we assume it. Everyone assumes it. It's just when you come to account for it, you can't account for it. And so you wind up in one version of Humeanism or Kantianism, basically, depending on how you take it, which all really means that we can't help, but in Hume's case, it's an unavoidable habit. Right. In Kant's case, it's a necessary construction of some sort. But then you see, neither one of them can tell you a consistent, blurless story, even about how you do it, how you get the habit. In Hume's case, you cannot, there is no way in Hume's system that you can explain how, given what he says about the mind and its contents, you could ever have a habit. Habits. Indeed, indeed it is. Habits will have to turn out just to be another perception. And there's no way you can do this, and same way is in Kant. So that's one main argument. See, the other argument is, again, the one you're talking, is, well, build it up phenomenologically. Do your descriptions. Start with, if you wish, cases of fulfillment. And talk and try to explain what's going on. And then, of course, there are many cases where you can't have substantial fulfillment. It's still true for Husserl. Most of the things we know by theories and inferences and that sort of thing, especially scientific stuff. Very little you can actually fulfill. So logical proof, and we have to talk about that. Logical proof, I haven't said a word about that. And logical proof is not fulfillment, but it is a way of knowing. Now, the trick is, in your understanding of the logical principles, you have to know those fundamentally by fulfillment. The basic logical principles have to be verifiable by intuition. Modus ponens, non-contradiction, maybe, you know. All you need is just a few of them, and you can get all the rest by deduction. But you have to explicate the rules of inference in such a way that they're based on intuition. As long as you can do that, you satisfy him. And then you can even turn it over to machines. Husserl realized that in science, much of what we know by means of machines. And that was true at the turn of the century. Even in the turn of the century, science had lost its hold on intuition. You could no longer intuitively grasp most of the stuff that science dealt with. So he's very big on that. Yes. The sensa? Well, in this case, the sensa that are involved will be some sort of linguistic or other imagery. Right? Here, for example, is a simple principle of logic. You may know the rule of aversion. All A is B. And I'd like you to start thinking about this, actually, because I have to come back to this later. No non-B is A. Now that's a rule. And the problem is you're apt to just say, well, it's a rule. Yeah, but if that's all you've got, you'll never, you can't, you have to work with cases, like all swans are living beings. No non-living being is a swan. Now see, this is not yet to the level of logical abstraction, but if you just think about these, I think you'll see that if this is true, this has to be true. See that it has to be true. See. Intuition, right? And all you need to do is just do this with a few basic principles, and you're home. Because you can get the rest of them by deduction, by rules that are verifiable in intuition. Okay, I'm going to have to quit for today now, and I'm sorry to rob you of the time. So I will start next time by talking about this. I want to have a general discussion of how it is we know anything at all about acts of cognition. Right? Like, how do you know that you're now hearing the air conditioner? Right? And we will start there next time. Now, if in your reading, begin now with Hack, and do try to get through the first chapter, because we're still going to be cleaning up this other stuff, I think, but try to get the first chapter done, and that won't be much to worry you with as you try to work on your paper. And now, Friday, if you want to have asked questions relevant to your thinking about your paper, we can take some time for that too. Also, let me say that I do encourage you to talk with one another about the subject, and just, of course, write your papers separately, but it's great to have discussions with one another of this kind. Thanks very much.